So Thomas mentioned in his opening comments that often you will see evolution and, of course, deep time and other aspects of the Big Bang and so on presented as a fact and not as an interpretation. Here's one example. No educated person any longer questions the validity of the so-called theory of evolution, which we now know to be a simple fact. Likewise, most of Darwin's particular theses have been fully confirmed, such as that of common descent, the gradualism of evolution, and his explanatory theory of natural selection. So this is a fact. I have to chuckle here because you'll notice he makes this false dilemma. No educated person can believe this, right? Questions of validity. So either I'm uneducated or I am stupid. Well, Dawkins would say I was stupid in one of his comments, because if I question the theory of evolution, I can't be educated. So you would think that somebody like this Ernst Mayr, who was a well-educated person, would see the logic mistake he makes here, but putting that aside. Thomas, you've already covered, and I didn't realize you were giving the opening thoughts here for me, right? But the evolution, the question is evolution a science? And it's really an historical interpretation of the evidence that you see around you. But a science deals with observable processes in the present. When we're talking about evolution, we're talking about history. And so evolution isn't a science. It's an historical interpretation, as is Genesis. And so we have to look at what the facts tell us and then interpret them through the two interpretive worldviews. And evolution isn't derived from the evidence. It's actually imposed on the evidence. Here's an example from Michael Denton's book. He says, such claims that evolution is a fact no longer needing proof are simply nonsense. By the way, this is not a Christian writing this. Far from it. For Darwin's model of evolution is still very much a theory and still very much in doubt when it comes to macroevolutionary phenomena. Furthermore, being basically a theory of historical reconstruction, he admits that it's historical, not science. It is impossible to verify by experiment or direct observation, as is normal in science. Michael Denton, Evolution, a Theory in Crisis. So if evolution from molecules to man occurred, if it did, it occurred in the distant past, and it's not observable today, and it's not repeatable. And so the conflict that we are dealing with here is not between the Bible and religion and science. It's between two interpretations of history. That's what we're dealing with here. We should take a moment and define evolution so that we have a consistent understanding of what we mean by it, because it is used in a spectrum of definitions. So when I'm using the term evolution, it's the idea that we began with some form of self-replicating molecule or an original cell that had a certain amount of genetic information, and then over time that genetic information has been increasing in the variety of life that we see around us. And if you look at the nodes on this tree of life, at the very top are all of the current species that are in existence today. Some species have died out. Some are only found in the fossil record. And then there are the gaps, and evolutionists will call them missing links. In fact, I won't take the time now, but I have a number of articles where the latest missing link has been found, and they use that term. So these are on the branches, are where no fossils, no living examples are found. Just in case you're thinking I'm creating a straw man definition here, Lynn Margulis, very famous evolutionist, no longer alive, but said every form of life on earth, oak, tree, and elephant, bird, and bacterium, shares a common ancestry coming from that original self-replicating molecule or cell with every other form. This fact has been conclusively demonstrated by more than a century of evolutionary research. So this is the definition of evolution. Keep this in mind. Way back at the beginning, what, roughly a billion years ago, this single cell came into existence and had a amount of genetic information. And over a billion years, this genetic information has expanded and increased in its complexity. So what difference does it make? I believe in Jesus. He's my Savior. Isn't that all I need? Or the way, Thomas, you put it, we know the gospel, right? That's the evidence. Couldn't God have used evolution to create life? Couldn't he have used that process? And there are many Christians, and they are believers, they're professing believers, who will tell you that it's God used evolution as his process. But we have problems with this because the plants and animals, we are told, were created by their kinds, and they were not created from pre-existing material. And Hebrews 11:3 is very key in this because it makes it clear, the writer makes it clear, that the things that we see were not created from things that already existed, and we accept that on faith. Mankind is a unique creation. We're told that in Genesis 1, 26 and 27. Mankind is not the result of a million years of pre-hominoid evolution. Then if mankind is the product of evolution, then Genesis 1 is only a story. And why would you accept anything the Bible says if you can't accept Genesis 1 and what God says that he did? And we should all have a desire to know what the truth is because Jesus says the truth will set you free. And so we should want to know what the truth is. And so we should be trying to explore what evidence is supporting evolution or what the Bible teaches. And we've already seen from Thomas's presentation that belief in evolution undermines any foundation for morality. And that testimony you gave was of that murderer, right? It makes that clear, or Hitler is another example. And evolution is not accepted on evidence. It is accepted because people do not want to believe that there is a God. They don't want to believe that God is the creator. They don't want to believe it because the moment they believe that God is the creator, then they are morally accountable to him. And that's why we need to care about this. Because simply, belief in evolution is a form of idolatry. And you remember what Elijah said, whom are you going to serve, God or Baal? That's really the question. Now, often people who want to critique creationists will say, well, you believe that all these species were created all at one time, and then over millennia, some of them have gone extinct. Some went extinct in the flood, some went extinct in the ice age, and some are going extinct today. And therefore, they get into these conundrum where they say, well, how did God get all, or how did Noah put all of those species in the ark? Well, that's a caricature, and that is not what creationists believe. Rather, we believe that God created all the different plants and animals by their kinds. And that term is used quite a bit in the opening account in Genesis 1. By their kinds, and from that initial genetic information in a kind became the spectrum of species within that kind area. And it exploded after the flood. There may have been explosion before the flood as well, and then that was all wiped out. But the kinds that Noah took into the ark with him, there was an explosion of kinds, that we see around us today, as some of them were killed during the Ice Age, no question about it, and some are going extinct today, but there's a proliferation. We're going to look at a little ways down here how some of that occurred. But what's happening here is not that genetic information is increasing through time, but it's decreasing in time. Because as the species form from their original kinds, they have less genetic information than another species. And we'll see some examples of this. So this is the biblical model where animals and plants are created by their kinds, and then they've exploded into variety within their genetic spectrum of information. So here's an example. The one right in the center is our luxurious cat who thinks he owns the house. But these are one kind here, probably all of one kind. Now, you can't breed a lion and a domestic cat. They are separate species today. But originally, they were probably all one kind, and the genetic diversity that's available within the spectrum of that kind has split off into the different species. And so the genetic diversity has actually declined because there is less genetic information in a domestic cat than there was in the original kind, and less genetic information in a lion than there was in the original kind. And so there's been a loss of information, less complexity, as the kind has been diversifying into species. Here's another example, and this is variation within a kind. And we know that broad spectrum within the canine kind that not only gives wolves and coyotes, but also gives domestic dogs. And then within that, all of the breeds within the dogs. On Sunday when we were driving home from church, my daughter was in the car with me, one of my daughters, and I said to her, we were talking about dogs, and I said, just look up what are the smartest dogs and what are the stupidest dogs. And almost all the stupid dogs are those little decorative dogs that people like to have. All the smart dogs are working dogs. So we were looking at that list. But this is a form of selection, not natural selection, artificial selection, that has been imposed very harshly on the canine kind of through selective breeding, but they're all still dogs after 3,000 years of selective breeding. And you know what happens when you breed dogs, breeds too much, they become weak over time. One of my wife's cousins bred Dalmatians, and in every third generation, he would breed husky into the Dalmatian line because the Dalmatians got weaker and weaker as the generations went along. There was information decay, mutations going on, and that you know that that's it. I have a friend who raises Great Danes, and Great Danes have heart problems. They don't last very long because they have weak hearts. This is the problem when you have less genetic information and diversity. If you want a really good dog, just get a mutt. That's all the variety in it. So evolution's supposed driving forces are natural selection, which creationists accept, by the way, just like we accept artificial selection in the breeding of dogs, mutations, which we accept as well, that occur. And so what you have here is a developing research area on how the vast biodiversity on Earth evolves, accepts natural selection and three other established forces of evolution as its basis. These include mutation, random genetic drift, and gene flow. Now, we're not going to deal with random genetic drift and gene flow right now. Let's just focus on natural selection and mutation, both of which are observable facts, and we accept those. It's how you interpret them is the problem. So let's define natural selection and mutation. So we have a clear example of natural selection, where we have a variety of fur lengths available within the original canine kind. And the first canine pair, say, just for the sake of discussion, had medium length fur. And so they had a gene for long fur, a gene for short fur, and they could produce offspring, some of which had, and when these original canine kind started to distribute after they'd left Noah's Ark, some of them ended up in colder climes, and the long-furred variety survived best and over time gave birth to the long-furred variety. And what happened is, through natural selection, is that they became more specialized and they lost the genetic information for short fur. They had less genetic information. It wasn't added, they had less. And so the genetic information in that smaller population in the northern climes with the long fur did not have any of the genetic information anymore to produce the short-haired version. And this is the opposite of the micros to man evolutionary, which says that information is being added, whereas what we're seeing, observable science, is that information is being lost when species are forming. They're becoming less diverse, not more diverse. And so this wide spectrum of genetic possibilities is available. Take an example of the equine kind. Noah probably took just the two of this kind into the ark. And then when they've come out of the ark, we have donkeys and we have zebras and we have horses and we have the different species that have come from that. And you know how many breeds there are, say, within the horse species. Here we have another example of the human spectrum of genetic possibilities, where you have, just in terms of skin color, and this couple had two sets of twins, and you can see the variety of the color. My wife is from Puerto Rico. She was blonde and light-skinned. Her sister is dark-skinned and black hair from the same family. So this genetic variety is there. Here's examples of twins where somebody once asked Richard, when he uses his example, are these identical twins? Duh. They are twins. So, but these are different examples of twins from diversity within the human population. And so this wide spectrum of genetic possibilities was what came out of the ark in the kinds, and these, as the migrations occurred from the ark, which was at Mount Ararat, somewhere in the Turkey area or Iraq or somewhere in that vicinity, and they spread out around the world, these populations would become isolated. And we see one example where God sends people out to populate the earth after the Tower of Babel because they were attempting to stay concentrated, and God confused the language and spread them out. And as they, small populations speaking a particular language started to migrate away, and they became culturally distant from other people and geographically distant, their genetic information became less over time as they spread out. Here's an example of how evolution is misrepresented. A tea plant was discovered about 2 years ago in a province of China. And this is a black tea, a standard black tea, and it's caffeine-free. If you're interested, by the way, I wrote an article on this that should be appearing in the next edition of Creation Magazine, the one that's going to print right now on this tea, so you can get more information about it. But an article that appeared in The Economist magazine about this says on tea plant, says that the absence of caffeine is the result of a mutation in the gene that codes for the enzyme, and the gene that codes for the enzyme is called caffeine synthase, and it's made its evolutionary journey toward losing caffeine. Now, this is a bait and switch, because the definition of evolution is increasing information, increasing complexity. And here they're saying it's lost information. The mutation has caused it to lose the ability to produce caffeine. And anecdotally, caffeine is a pesticide, and it protects the tea plant. So when you have your tea and your coffee in the morning, you're drinking a pesticide. Here's another example. The findings which were published in this evolutionary biology journal says the black squirrel is actually a gray squirrel with its faulty pigment gene carried over from the fox squirrel that turns their fur a darker shade. So the black squirrel is a mutation that's lost the ability to produce a particular pigment. And Thomas has written an article that was published, 2 weeks ago on our website about white squirrels. And he lives in Exeter, and they have white squirrels. And I'd never heard of these until Thomas's article came out. And this is, again, a genetic defect that's caused this loss of information. And it was a gray squirrel as well. Now, these are protected by law in Exeter and the human protecting them, and so they natural selection is not eliminating them, but they probably wouldn't survive in the wild because they would stand out and not be, the gray would be more protected. So is there any evidence that evolution happens? Well, it's claimed that evolution is supported by, but we're not going to examine this one today here, but the differences are far greater than most people realize. Just to give you an example, you could take a marsupial dog, which have gone extinct within the past 100, 150 years, marsupial dogs and placental dogs, and their skeletons look the same, but their anatomy was quite different. So comparative similarities is not a good way to do it. And that is not the best example for it. So, but the similarities actually are a positive indicator of a designer, because God reused good designs for various ways of creating the various types of animals and plants around us. Just as an example, hemoglobin appears multiple times throughout the various forms of living entities, including some plants have hemoglobin in them. And yet, you go back to the supposed common ancestors, there's no hemoglobin there. They can't find where hemoglobin supposedly came into the tree of life. Biochemistry is another argument that is often used. But the very fact is that God used biochemical building blocks, otherwise we couldn't eat. It's that simple. If he didn't use proteins throughout the design of life, we couldn't eat. And so biochemistry isn't necessarily a good example. And so we have concepts and designs that God reuses throughout his creation. Just like a design that has two wheels and a motorcycle, or a truck has 16 wheels or whatever they have, that doesn't mean that the best evidence for evolution. Fossils, which we're not going to consider today. Am I doing fossils tomorrow? I'm not sure which one I'm doing tomorrow. I'm doing the flood. So I may deal with fossils a bit tomorrow. I'm doing dinos at 9 o'clock and then the flood, I think. Forget. But the missing links, clearly are there. And what is amazing when they look at an example, actually Thomas put up an example there. What'd you call it? An ichthy something? Ichthyosaurus. If you were to look at its skeleton today, you would say it's a dolphin. It's got the same thing as a dolphin. You will find in the fossil record crocodiles that look essentially the same as crocodiles today. So, in fact, the fossil record indicates a lot of stasis rather than evolution. That is, things are similar. Now, yes, there are types of animals that have gone extinct that we don't have examples of today, but where you have the comparisons, it's showing stasis. It's not the best way to defend it. But the one that is used the most is genetic variation. This is the primary one that evolutionists use. So let's look at it as an example. So without doubt, changes take place, and they occur within a broad spectrum of genetic information that is available. But there are limits beyond which no change has ever been observed within that spectrum. And evolutionists will tell you that the mutations are introducing change, and they're the engine that's driving positive change and increasing complexity of information. Here's an example. This you can look up on the UC, University of California, Berkeley website on their evolution page. So this is a prominent University of California, Berkeley. And this is what they describe as an example of evolution. Drug resistance in bacteria is claimed to be an example of evolution. Now notice, though, this is taken right from UC Berkeley of bacteria. It's already there. And then when you introduce the antibiotic, what happens over time is that all the antibiotic resistance won. But you notice they call this evolution. This is not evolution. These instances of bacteria that can resist the antibiotic already existed in the pool of bacteria. They existed. And the evidence is not for evolution. Just one other example. Michigan State University study was done, and they took the E. coli bacteria. They studied it over 67,000 generations. They basically saw every type of mutation imaginable repeating and occurring over time. Through 67,000 generations, none, not a single instance of these mutations were a positive. Every one of the mutations, and they occurred, sometimes they would find them occurring in multiple times because certain parts of the gene tend to mutate more than other parts because there's error correction built into DNA. And not a single instance after 67,000 generations. This is with an E. coli bacteria which got a small amount of genetic information. Try to think just logically for a second. How many possible conceivable generations could there have been in the humankind according to evolutionists? Let's say 500,000 years. How many possible? Certainly not 67,000. And yet all of the increases in complexity in the evolution from an ape-like creature to humans are supposed to have occurred in a few thousand generations when E. coli never changes in 67,000, and there's not a single instance of a positive mutation. But antibiotic resistance has been around. When they discovered the Franklin expedition off the coast of Antarctica. They had died of the cold, and they froze to death, the Franklin expedition. And they exhumed the bodies. They found the antibiotic resistance bacteria in these bodies. In tribes, native tribes that have had no contact with the civilized world, if you can allow me to use that phrase, have had no contact with antibiotics at all, those antibiotic resistant bacteria are there. When they took a drug sample, a stool sample that had been preserved from a soldier that died during the First World War, and they examined it, they found that antibiotic resistance bacteria in that stool sample. And so this isn't evolution. The bacteria already exists, and it's existed long before antibiotics came on the scene. And this is not a form of evolution. So changes do take place within the existing range. And often that change is a result of mutations. Sometimes it isn't. It's just the variety is there. And as I gave you the example of the canine kind, natural selection causes some of that change to occur. But the mutations occur almost overwhelmingly when they occur. They're negative and they are information lost. They are also could be benign or they're negative. There isn't never been an example of a positive mutation that's been reported in observational science. And I'm going to extend that in a moment in case you don't believe me on that. So I'm not going to deal with some other complexities that I've mentioned earlier, gene insertion and duplication and rearrangement. Those are complexities that are too much for here. But just dealing about mutations as how genetic information changes through time. So here we have a cardinal that's yellow in form. It has lost the ability to produce a pigment, and it is a mutation that is a loss of information. Here we have things like diseases, cystic fibrosis, and deformities, and deterioration like lactose intolerance are a loss of genetic information. They are mutations that are negative. And even if one in a million was beneficial, natural selection would eliminate it long before it could actually survive in the population, because you have one instance isolated there over the huge populations of things, and we've seen that from the E. coli example, although all of the examples in the E. coli study were negative. There was never a positive one. The chance that it would be selected, the positive one would be selected, is pretty remote. And what's happening here is biologic change is running in the wrong direction. We're seeing deterioration. Evolution is positive. Information increase, not deterioration. And this is consistent with the biblical message, by the way, where Paul says in Romans that the whole creation is groaning in its decay, waiting for its redemption. So I stated that all mutations are harmful. Let's just examine that for a second. This is Nature Periodicals website. They give a whole lot of detailed information about mutations. It's page after page after page. There's only one example on that entire page that is an example of a supposedly beneficial mutation. And that the example they give is sickle cell anemia. And at the very end of the article, you've got to read through, I suppose if you printed it, it's going to be 20 or 30 pages. It's way down to the bottom. You can go to it on nature.com and just look at it. And they say this: together, these different classes of mutations and their causes serve to place organisms at risk for disease and to provide the raw material for evolution. Thus, mutations are often detrimental to individuals because they've gone through this long list of mutations and they're all detrimental. And I'll come to sickle cell anemia in a moment. And then they say, but they serve to diversify the overall population. So what they have argued here is what's bad for the individual is good for the population, but there isn't a shred of evidence given on the website. And it's way down at the bottom where they make this statement. So let's deal with this statement about sickle cell anemia. What it does is it reduces an individual's susceptibility to malaria, which is a good thing that you're not susceptible to malaria. But there's a high cost here because 25% of children that have sickle cell anemia die. So the survival rate of children is much lower than normal. And so the ability to carry oxygen in the blood is reduced and these children die. Not sure you can call this a good mutation because it's impeding the ability for the body to carry oxygen throughout the body. But this is the only example that they even come close to calling good in that website. Here's an interesting one that's very current. The new coronavirus is mutating, Popular Science magazine. But that's not a bad thing. And their argument is that the mutations are weakening it. One of our geneticists, scientists on the CMI staff, he said that he expects in 2 years, roughly, he's not being absolute, within 2 years, the coronavirus will have mutated so much that it'll be gone. It'll be so ineffective. Because this is what happens with these viruses over time. They mutate. Now, new ones form, and they come into the population from different sources, something from bats or from different places. But they come in, but over time they mutate. The bulk of mutations that appear as a virus spreads are either harmful to the virus itself, meaning it is less likely to survive or replicate, or they don't change how it functions. They're benign. Popular Science magazine. So they're saying that mutations are harmful and positive on coronavirus. So evolutionary proponents of evolution contradict themselves because they're either bad or good. So they will tell you, for instance, with genetically modified foods, GMO, that they don't produce more viable offspring. In fact, hybrids will not survive generally in the wild. They are genetically inferior. And so here's an example where the results to date have been reassuring in the genetically altered organisms have proved to be less viable than their wild type counterparts and hence unable to affect existing ecosystems. So human-directed genetic change is causing less viability. Under what conceivable way would random genetic change make them more viable? So mutations are always detrimental or at best neutral. The bacteria H. pylori, which it can become antibiotic resistance. Its antibiotic resistance is the loss of an ability to produce a particular enzyme. And enzymes are important for manufacturing proteins. When DNA is manufacturing, it's not the DNA, it's when the RNA is manufacturing the proteins, that they need enzymes to be present to do it. Another example is the tuberculosis bacteria. It's a mutation, and it weakens the bacteria overall, but it becomes antibiotic resistance, but the bacteria itself is weaker and it's overall. And here's another example where they were creating genetically modified mosquitoes, and they were less fertile, less healthy after they'd been altered. So mutations are the supposed engine for evolution to create better entities. It ignores a fundamental reality, and that is that genes don't suddenly pop into existence. There has to be a gene there that can actually be modified with a mutation before anything can occur, before any form of change can occur. And there's no evidence at all that genes are built up from smaller components through time. In fact, every example of mutations, other than the classic that they try to put forward, sickle cell anemia, is detrimental. And so we should conclude that all mutations are either benign or detrimental. And so there's never been an example of demonstrable change beyond what probably is close to the kind in the Bible, which is around the family in the taxonomic codes. It's not absolute, but in that general area, never has there been any examples of genetic change beyond the family level or the kind level. So variation doesn't produce new taxonomic families. And here we have an interesting example, a camel. It's a breed between a llama and a camel. You would have never thought of llamas and camels could interbreed because llamas are from South America and camels are from Middle East and Asia, but they can interbreed. They don't necessarily produce fertile offspring, just like when horses and donkeys breed, the hinnies or the mules, depending on whether it's male or females, the hinnies and mules are not necessarily fertile. But they originally were in the common kind, but they've been separated too long and they've lost genetic information. An example that has been presented by evolutionists is the Darwin finches. And there's no question that the distribution of the beaks on these finches changed depending on how dry the climate is, how moist the climate is, how the seeds of their favorite plants are, and so on. And these beaks do change. And this has been presented as an example of evolution. The interesting thing is that when the climate changes again through its cycles in the Galapagos Islands, the beak combinations will revert back to what they were before. Well, back in 1998, the National Academy of Science published a book for school teachers in which they asked them to speculate on Darwin's finches and what would happen after 200 years if these changes continue to occur. What they don't say in the article is that the next time the climate shifted back and changed and it went from dry to more moist or changes like that, that the mix changed back. They don't say that. They just assume that it's unidirectional. But the finches never changed in anything else through those cycles. Another example is lizards. That it's often presented in the literature as examples of evolution. After a hurricane in the Caribbean, it might wipe out vast swaths of life, and then the lizards come back in and they proliferate and they spread all over into their new niches and there's a lot of variety in them. That isn't evolution. There's that variety built in to the lizard kind and they have that genetic availability to fill different niches as they become available. Not additional information, just change within the spectrum. And we've never seen examples of one kind changing into another kind. No observational example has ever occurred. So we've already dealt earlier this morning with this, this evening, with the concept of observational science, which is you have to observe it. You can do it through natural observation, through stage observation. You can use quantitative methods. Qualitative, different. There are different ways of doing observation. But that isn't what we see is happening in speciation. It's not increasing genetic information. Now, I just want to summarize some of the problems that evolutionists have. The origin of the DNA molecules. It was supposed by a study that was done by Stanley Miller back in the 1950s that if he could just take the right constituents of what they thought were could create amino acids, which is what proteins are built out of, they could actually form the constituents of life. And Scientific American reported that all he got was basically tar, sludge, in his experiments. So a lot of energy and thought and expense has gone into trying to fabricate or to synthesize life. We carry this book. It's published last year. It's called The Stairway to Life. I read it actually on my flight out to Calgary just after it had come out. And I started rereading it a second time on my flight here this morning. It is mind-blowing book. I highly recommend, if you're at all interested in the concept of life coming from non-life, that you read this book. It's easy to read. And just one statement from it, from recently acquired insights into the into the complexity of the simplest organisms, Tan and Stadler, the authors of this book, specify requirements for spontaneous formation of life and evaluate the prospects for natural processes to satisfy these requirements. And the conclusion is it's impossible, absolutely impossible for life to have formed spontaneously. And if you are skeptical on this statement I've just made, I highly recommend you read this book because it'll just blow your mind in terms of how difficult it is for life to come into existence. And even if the genetic code could have arisen spontaneously, we have a chicken and egg problem. Because a major difficulty with the notion that DNA contains all the required information is that this information seems useless without the surrounding cell machinery. DNA is only meaningful in a cellular context in which it can express itself, in which there is an iterative cyclical relationship between the DNA and its context. And so we have this chicken and egg problem. If you don't have the cell around the DNA, you're not going to have replication of DNA. An analogy would be this. DNA is like a blueprint for a cell phone. That's what DNA is like. It's far more complex than that. But let's just say it's all of the manufacturing instructions to make a cell phone. Okay, I have raw material and I have a blueprint. Go at it. What's missing? It's the factory. You have to get it all there. And just having DNA coming into existence spontaneously, you need the infrastructure around it, which is the cell, the RNA, and the enzymes, and all the parts that are needed. Well, the answer to this, by the way, is deep time. The idea is, evolutionists are absolutely convinced that if we just allow things to go on long enough, self-replicating molecules and systems will become into existence. And why do they suppose the impossible is possible? Because the alternative is unacceptable to them, and that is special creation. So they've come up with all kinds of ways for the origin of the genetic code. Some have proposed that, well, you need an infrastructure in which molecules can replicate, and they've created these idea that, well, they form in layers of clay, mineral structures, or the molecules have come from space. One of the co-discoverers of the helix of DNA, Watson or Crick, I don't remember which one, but he believed in what's called galactic transpermia, the idea that life came from the galaxies, because he admitted that it didn't come spontaneously on this earth. And so amino acids from space. Evolution admit that they have no idea how DNA formed. For example, Stephen Hawking, somehow some atoms came to be arranged in the form of molecules of DNA. We do not know how DNA molecules first appeared. The chances against a DNA molecule arising by random fluctuations are very small. That's an understatement, by the way, very small. And he goes on to speculate, well, since they're here, it must have happened. And, of course, they dismiss the idea that God could have created because they believe that a natural explanation is going to come. But then let's take it a little further up the chain here. The genetic code isn't hardware, it is software. It's a program for manufacturing proteins. It's the guidance for manufacturing that. Even if the hardware could be generated by chance, The information in DNA is a whole layer of complexity of life that goes way beyond the nucleotides that make up the DNA. A nucleotide is made up of a phosphate group, a sugar, and a nitrogen group, and there are four of them. They're like in computers, there's binary code, zeros and ones. In DNA, it's based on four, not zero and one, but four, and they create letters out of which words and whole sentences are formed. But that information is the complexity of life. Paul Davies, a physicist, not a Christian by any means, how did nature fabricate the world's first digital information processor, the original living cell, from the blind chaos of blundering molecules? How did molecular hardware get to write its own software? The problem isn't having the nucleotides. The problem isn't having amino acids. The problem is the information that's encoded in DNA. And DNA is incredibly complex. And the more that it's being studied, and as the genome projects are going on in decoding the various genomes, they're finding amazing things about DNA. Just to give an example, information in DNA can be read in both directions. And it can be used to produce different RNA complexes that will then produce different proteins, different directions. You try to write a sentence that has meaning and can be read in both directions. DNA can be read in both directions for different purposes. I use an example of palindromes. Madam, I'm Adam. Or Abel was I ere I saw Elba. But you try to write any sentences that can be understood in both directions. You can start at different places in the double helix, and it'll depend on what's called epigenetic information. There can be electrical and chemical signals sent into the cell, and it says, I need a protein over here, and the DNA will start from this point, and it'll take different sequences of words from the structure. There are switches in DNA that can be turned on and off. It's mind-boggling in its complexity. And if there's anything that has stamped made by God, it's DNA. And evolutionists have no explanations for it. And their basic idea is that it's just will occur if we have enough time, by chance. So there was this Origin of Life Science Foundation around the year 2000, I think it was. They offered $1 million prize to anyone, and this is what their statement said, proposing a highly plausible natural process mechanism for the spontaneous rise of genetic instructions in nature sufficient to give rise to life. $1 million. If you could give a plausible explanation. 13 years later, they canceled it. It was never paid out. Nobody had come forward with the ability to explain how genetic instructions could arise by chance. In 2013, they canceled the offering. Never paid it out. Darwin said that if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive flight modifications, 1850, he knew nothing about genetics. Mendel was doing his P studies around that time, published his first papers slightly after, a year or two after Darwin's book came out on the Origin of Species. And when Mendel published his genetic studies, nobody paid any attention to him for a while. Darwin knew nothing about the complexity of the cells. To his mind, it was just an amorphous mass of protoplasm. Darwin knew nothing about DNA. And so his whole theory is premised on a simple, simplistic view of life. But take it at a high level. And I'm going to take it to low level in a moment, but Just take one example, eggs. In theory, evolutionists will tell you that fish evolved into amphibians, it evolved into reptiles, that evolved into mammals. Well, all of those have eggs, but there is no similarity between a fish egg, an amphibian egg, a reptilian egg, a bird egg, and a mammalian egg. And yet they'll tell you that that's an evolutionary chain across those. And how you could get that slight changes, or how you can get feathers versus scales, and it's just at the higher level. The Bible's answer is very simple. God created in a mature form. But let's take it down to the molecular level, which Darwin knew nothing about. Michael Behe, a professor of biological science at Lehigh University, has gotten into this at the molecular level, and he's given examples of what he calls molecular machines, and where if you remove any single part of them, it won't work, and you cannot explain how they came, could have occurred by building up the small components, because the individual components have no use. It's only when they're all assembled together. And in his first book that he published on this, called Darwin's Black Box, he says, if you search the scientific literature on evolution and if you focus your search on the question of how molecular machines, the basis of life developed, paralyzed science's attempt to account for it. Well, 20 years later, he wrote Darwin Evolves, and he was addressing the problem. It's gotten worse in the past 20 years. The complexity of life is even more complex, in, as we've been discovering, and his skeptics have not given any credible answers. And boosters of Darwin support a theory that labors mightily to explain a crummy 2-amino acid residue disulfide bond, but cannot account for more complex structures. Darwinian mechanism is self-limiting, capable only of eliminating or modifying pre-existing molecular systems, incapable of building functionally complex structures. By the way, I'm not recommending Darwin's Black Box or Darwin Devolves. Behe is essentially a theistic evolutionist. It's sad. His material at the molecular level is very good, but and he also accepts deep time. So I'm not recommending his books. But what he does talk about molecular complexity is quite mind-expanding. Take it up a level. So we have a primitive cell which has some DNA in it. And the interesting problem is, how then do we get a cell with a nucleus? And there are theories about what's called cell capture. Nobody has ever seen it, not observational scientists. The simplest self-replicating cell has about 482 genes, and it's very complex. The amount of information in the mechanics of that are more complex than a modern automobile, and yet this is supposed to have come up through random phenomena. Let's take it up a level. You have single cells, how did they, entities? We are composed of all kinds of different cells, skin cells, brain cells, spinal cells, and so on. We have all kinds of different cells. How did they all learn to cooperate together? An amoeba, or take it up a level. You have an amoeba, if you remember maybe from high school science, that the chromosomes would replicate, and then the amoeba would split. And it's called asexual reproduction. It has not bisexual. How did cells decide to take two sets of chromosomes from two different cells, bring them together, and work cooperatively to create a new entity in sexual reproduction? Scientific American article proposes a theory for Y chromosomes and X chromosomes and how they formed into using the two sets of chromosomes. And it's a fascinating read because probably, deduce, seem, apparently, these are the words that are used throughout. Nothing from observational science. It's all speculative on how this occurred. And even if a viable life form were to have suddenly spontaneously come into existence, which was a male entity of whatever species or kind that was out there, at the same time, in the same location, you would have had to have spontaneously coming into existence a female entity that could share chromosomes. It's mind-boggling. Take it up a level, the concept of convergence. You see, throughout the variety of life, you see God reusing design components. And evolutionists will tell you that flight has evolved multiple times in the insects and birds and bats and so on. Or eyes is another example. The human eye is very similar to octopuses and squid eyes, and yet, according to the tree of life, we don't have a common ancestor. Where the eye arrives. And I mentioned hemoglobin already, but it occurs around various places in plants and animals, and yet if you go back in the tree of life, the common ancestor doesn't necessarily have the constituents of it. It's beyond belief how this complex protein would have appeared multiple times by chance, and yet a designer would reuse it. And I've already mentioned species stasis. But here is the idea that species stasis is birth gives birth to like. Gives birth to like. You don't see new entities coming into existence. And the fossil record actually supports species stasis. And take it up a level to symbiotic relationships. This is a snow skink. Tasmanian snow skink, and this honey bush is the way it has to pollinate is it has a very hard shell around the flower, and when it's ready to be pollinated, the snow skink has to peel back the hard shell, and then the pollination can occur. And an article here in The Economist, why did the honeybush evolve such a complicated procedure for its pollination? Think of the absurdity of what this prestigious news journal is saying here. Oh, I'm a honeybush. I've got to figure out how to pollinate. It's anthropomorphizing honeybushes, making them think. It's kind of absurd. Evolution is supposed to be entirely random. I use this example in my relevance talk, the pollination of tomatoes. And I ask people if they raise tomatoes and how they're pollinated. A little bit, they can be pollinated by wind, or you can go and you can actually hand pollinate them if you're growing them in a greenhouse. But if you want proliferation of tomatoes, you need honeybees. No, you need bumblebees, not standard bees, bumblebees. And do you know the reason why? It's because bumblebees hum at middle C. And when they hum at middle C and they hum in front of the flower opens up for pollination. This is a symbiotic relationship. Symbiotic relationships occur all throughout nature, and evolutionists cannot explain it. Sociobiology is another problem for evolutionists. I read just recently, I don't know where I read it. It was on a science journal that I read. This leading sociobiologist. Now I can't think of his name. But he has another book. He's published like 30 books. But the problem with his sociobiology is why animals cooperate, like bees cooperate or ants cooperate, or why humans have altruistic tendencies. And the problem is that evolution explains too much, because evolution is also used to explain deviances. For example, a book was written a few years ago on basically defending rape as a form of evolutionary involvement, and that rape is an outcome of evolution. Or another example is here, which is in Science Daily. Human prejudice, an ancient evolutionary root. So the problem is that evolution explains too much, because it basically everything is natural. Everything is a result of evolution. So deviances are because of my genes. If I have homosexual tendency, it's my genes. If I'm a rapist, it's my genes. If I'm prejudiced, it's my genes. It explains too much. Basically, because everything is the result of evolution. And as we've seen from Thomas's presentation, when it explains everything, it explains nothing, and there's no basis for morality. So is there any evidence for evolution? Any evidence at all? Well, there isn't. There's none. There's not a single thread of empirical evidence that the microbes to man evolution has occurred, is occurring, or ever will occur. There's nothing that supports the idea that genetic complexity has been increasing through time. Evolution is a theory universally accepted, not because it can be proven by logically coherent evidence to be true, but because the only alternative, special creation, is clearly incredible. That wasn't written by a Christian. That was published in Nature magazine. Evolution is a theory without an empirical foundation, and therefore it isn't science. It ignores and rationalizes away any evidence that is presented against us. And plain and simply, it is in crisis. Why then is it so universally espoused? Because men suppress the truth at all costs. Most biologists accept it, that is evolution, as though it were a proven fact. Although this conviction rests upon circumstantial evidence, it forms a satisfactory faith on which to base our interpretation of nature. This was in the introduction to an edition of The Origin of the Species, a published edition in the introduction, not written by Darwin, but by the editor. Evolution is believed because it's the main prop of a faith, a religion without God. As one well-quoted example by Richard Lewontin, I'll just read you the end here. Moreover, the materialism is an absolute, we cannot allow a defined foot in the door. They do not want God. Is the simple reason. Now, we have good examples to counter evolution here. Our classic is the Creation Answers book. Genetic entropy is an important one for the talk I've been giving here because it shows a problem. I didn't deal with this issue today, but the genome is decaying. Plain and simply, the genome is decaying. And, of course, you can get all kinds of good stuff on creation.com. And the book, The Evolution's Achilles Heel, deals with the problems with evolution in a lot more detail than I've dealt with. And there's an accompanying video. There's an interesting DVD that you can get for free if you subscribe to Creation Magazine. Creations, and we have copies of it out there, creatures do change, but that's not evolution. And, of course, Creation Magazine that Thomas has mentioned, and the Genesis Academy we have. So that's our talk for this evening. Tomorrow, we will start with a presentation on dinos, which is a little more oriented to kids, although adults get a lot out of it too. I interact with the kids if there are any present. And then we have three other talks as well, don't we? Yeah. Two by Thomas and one other by me. And I've lost track of which ones I'm doing. So let's just close with a brief word of prayer. And then Thomas and I will be at the table for a little while. Lord, we acknowledge that you are the creator, the great creator, that you said how things came into being, and we need to accept what you say. We thank you for all of the truth that you communicate in your word. We ask that you would help us to communicate this to our next generation, to those in our churches, and to those outside the faith. We ask that you'd bless us now in Jesus' name. Amen.